running ahead of schedule. Now we're running behind schedule, so it makes us right on time again. That's good, logical, sane, rational thinking. I'm still Jim Daniel. I'm still an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
For those of you who were not here at the first session we had, I'd again like to welcome everybody and welcome those of you who were here again.
Welcome to the meeting, our speaker for tonight. We have invited Judy P. from Atlanta, GA, and I had the privilege and honor to have dinner with her tonight. I think you will find her one tough lady. Judy?
I'm Judy Pearson. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Judy.
David was reading the traditions. I thought, you don't have to go so fast, you know. You can slow down a little bit. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here tonight. It's funny how God works in my life. I'm continuously amazed by that. My husband and I both work 6 days a week, and periodically we just give out. And it seems like one of these always come up just about that time that we're both about ready to give out. And we get to spend some time away from home and away from the businesses and get to know one another again. And Louise has been such a lovely hostess. She called me at my home in Atlanta and wanted to know if there was anything she could do. And that's nice to have that feeling that there's a contact once you get there, somebody that you can ask for directions or anything. She's been wonderful, and thank you very much. So I'm grateful you all asked me, and I'm grateful to be here. My job tonight, as I understand it in Big Book and in the chapter of How It Works, is to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. And a lot of what I share with you will not be my own words. They'll be words I've heard from people in the program and since I've been here. I didn't get here with much sense. And so anything of value that I share with you is something that the program gave me. My sobriety date is December the 18th, 1972. I was desperate because I got sober 1 week before Christmas. I just didn't think I'd last. Yeah, it was a matter of desperation, and I think that's what gets all of us here, and in my case, that's what keeps me here. There was a lot that preceded that and a lot of things that I could go into, and I'm not going to do a whole lot of that tonight. I always pray a little bit before I do this, because I want to do what God wants me to do when I'm up here, and I always get dressed up in a suit, see, because my teachers taught me in this program that when you're standing in front of a room and you're representing Alcoholics Anonymous, you by God better look sober. So, this is looking sober. And I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous looking anything like this, I can promise you. I came from a Polish Catholic home, so that tells you why I ended up in this fellowship. I was real afraid I was going to be the only Catholic in AA. And then I heard Father Hillary, and Father Hillary, I love the man dearly, and I was really grateful because, you know, being a Catholic, I mean, if a priest could do it, it was okay, you know, and it didn't mean that I was doomed, and I learned a lot from Father Hillary. Father Hillary answered a question for me early on in the fellowship, and that question was why was I an alcoholic? You know, I was real worried about why, and AA wisdom is so simple, and it's so pure, and Father Hillary had the same question, and he posed that to his home group. And one of the old-timers, the deacons in the group, said, well, now, Father, it doesn't make any difference how the jackass fell in the ditch. Just get him out. Yeah. And that answered for me, and I quit asking myself why I was an alcoholic, and was I born an alcoholic, or did I become an alcoholic through the abuse of alcohol, and it really didn't make any difference. The bottom line was, and still is to this day, that if I drink, I get in trouble. If I drink, I cause a lot of trouble. If I drink, I am one miserable human being. No, and it doesn't make any difference why that happened. It doesn't make any difference why I'm an alcoholic. It doesn't change it. The first drink is deadly to me. I'm one of those people, too, in Alcoholics Anonymous that believes very, very strongly that this is not just a fellowship here. This is not just an organization where people get together and talk out their woes and their problems and how life has wronged them. I'm a big believer that this is a life-saving program, and we had always better keep it in that perspective and never let it fall anywhere else. I am here tonight, and I'm at every AA meeting I go to save my life. Now, because bottom line is for me, if I drink again, I have two options. I don't fear jail too much, but I do fear mental institutions because I've been there. No, I don't like insanity. I don't like my own insanity. No. And that is one option that I have, and the other is death. And since I have been in the program as long as I have, I found out there's an awful lot out there I want to live for. There's an awful lot of people out there that are real important to me and an awful lot of things I love. And I don't want to sacrifice that. I don't want to give that up anymore. I know, to return to the life that I led. My mother was divorced when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and she remarried an Irishman in the early stages of alcoholism. And to the due respect of the Al-Anons, because some of us shortchange their intelligence and say, you know, why would she marry something like that and stay with it? And the reason being, if their alcoholic was anything like my stepfather, because when he came into our lives, he was not the sick, full-blown alcoholic. When he came into our lives, he was a loving and kind and giving man who had a terrific sense of humor and a fantastic outlook on life. You know, and as the disease progressed and as it got worse, all that changed. It was a Jekyll Hyde. You know, and he became violent, and he became pessimistic, and he became critical, and he wasn't loving, and he wasn't sensitive, and he wasn't caring. And as a child, I remember asking myself, you know, what happened to him? What went wrong? You know, because as time progressed on, it got more and more difficult to live with him. Violence became a way of life in our home. Sexual abuse was a way of life. Emotional abuse was a way of life. And it was a nightmare. Every night was a nightmare. I took my first drink at the age of 10, and that let go of a lot of inhibitions for me. As a child, I had difficulty in speaking. I stuttered horribly, and it was very difficult for me to communicate with anyone. And I read a lot, and that was my escape mechanism. And I'd go into those fairy tales, and I loved them, you know, because it always had a happy ending. You know, everybody always lived happily ever after. And all my life, I was looking for the happily ever after. And the closest I ever came was in the booze. When I had the booze, that was the happily ever after. You know, that's where everything was okay and everything was peaceful and everything was calm. And I didn't have to care and I didn't have to hurt. It just didn't matter. You know, none of it mattered. And I'm a big believer, too, that had it not been for the drug alcohol at the age 16, I'd have blown my brains out. Now, that was the only thing that kept me from dealing with reality. It was the only thing that saved my life because I simply couldn't cope. The Vietnam War was going on then. There were race riots in the streets of our cities. People were getting beat with billy clubs. And when I'd turn on the TV and I'd see that garbage about the war and the riots, and I'd get sick and I'd go to bed and that stuff would keep me up at night. And when you're that sensitive and you're that exposed to that much pain, you know, you got no way out but to drink. That's the only way out I had. And I really do believe that the alcohol saved my life for a period of time. But see, just like anything else, it's the easy way out. Sooner or later, it's going to turn on you. Sooner or later, you're going to have to wake up and face reality. I used my relationship with my stepfather as my cop-out, as my reason to behave the way that I behaved. You know, it was okay for me to do the things I was doing because look at the way I was treated when I was a child. That is not true. You know, it reaches a point where society doesn't care what happened to you as a child. If you break the law, you break the law. Somewhere along the line, we're supposed to grow up. We're supposed to cope. But I elected not to do that, see, because that called for me to take some responsibility and that called for me to take some action. And I didn't want any of that. You know, I got out of high school and I went right to work, and the reason I did that is because I thought if I went to college, somebody put a limit on my drinking. You know, obviously I didn't know anybody who went to University of Georgia. I'm telling you. But I could just see some old pudgy matron standing at the door when I came in, smelling breath, you know. And I elected not to go, and that was the first decision in looking back over my life, major decision in life, that I made that was based solely and wholly on booze. Nothing was going to interfere with my drinking. I left home at 1920 and went and got an apartment by myself. And in looking at myself, in my inventories, I found out I did a lot of things by myself because I didn't want anything interfering with my drinking. And you see, if I had a roommate, I knew sooner or later that roommate was going to say to me, "Judy, you're drinking too much." I knew that because I'd already heard that. See, I took my first drink at the age of 10. By the time I was 14, I was a full-blown alcoholic. You know, because I was trying to drink every night. You know, I was an expert at watering down booze. I could take 20-year-old bourbon and have it looking like 30-year-old scotch in an hour, you know? Yeah. And that's why I didn't have any roommates. I used to get engaged a lot, too. You know, I had an exciting life. I used to get engaged to two guys at once. You know, and when you live like that, you got to drink a lot. You got one going out the back door and one coming in the front, and it's whew. And I'd get engaged to these fellas, and sooner or later, one of them would say, "Judy, if, you know, if this relationship's going to go any further, you got to do something about your drinking." And those men would be out of my life because nobody was going to stand between me and the bottle. Nobody. You know. There was, after I quit, I had a nice little job like one's supposed to, because, see, my family was real geared into what you're supposed to do, the right things to do. Now, granted, we weren't living right, but on the outside, it had to be right, okay? I had to work for the right firm, and I had to wear the right clothes. My stepfather had to be with the right firm, with the right title, drove the right car. We lived on the right side of town, the proper side of town, okay? And that was all real important, and it didn't matter what went on behind closed doors. That's not important. What's important is, what do they see out there? What do they see? Those people, you know, what do they see? And it just really amazes me, since I've been sober, that I tried so hard to impress those that I could have cared less about what they thought. You know, it really didn't matter. But it was real important to my family. Monetary gain was real important to my family. It was very important that you live in the right place and you have the right kind of job. And I had one of these right kind of jobs that had a little badge that said manager. But I quit that job because I was reported for drinking on the job. I wasn't, but I drank till 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was a bourbon drinker back then, and I didn't know bourbon would stay with you for 3 or 4 hours, you know. And I was sweating bourbon is what I was doing, and I got reported for drinking, but I quit. Because, you see, that job was threatened, my drinking was threatened, and they were on to me. Every self-respecting alcoholic I know is going to run from the scene when they're on to you. And you're going to maintain your dignity. You're going to quit before they fire you. You're going to quit, and that's exactly what I did. I made a brilliant decision based on clear alcoholic thinking. I was about 21, 22 at the time. And I decided the best thing for me to do now is to get into something that was more exciting and altogether different. And, of course, I was rebellious, so I wanted to get into something that would just make my stepfather cringe. And so I decided to become a cocktail waitress. That is why I got to the program at 23. I don't know how many of you have been in the bar and restaurant business, and especially at night. And I worked all night shifts. But that's crazy business. Now, if you're not a little loose when you get there, you will be when you leave. And I got a job. And as always, of course, I moved up. You know how we are. And I went from a cocktail waitress to a bartender. And I started having a lot of problems with the boss. You know, I started having a lot of problems with bosses. I started having a lot of problems with I had to have a couple of drinks by now before I went into work. And when you're working in a bar, that's okay, because you know which one of your customers are going to smell it. I mean, they're all drinking, so. But the personalities were getting in the way. The violence had long been a problem with me as far as hitting people. See, I wasn't a dainty drunk. I was a barroom brawler is what I was. And I'd hit people when they disagreed with me. And That doesn't do much for your tips. And my friends would say to me, Judy, you know, the guy is 6'4" and weighs 290. You're crazy, woman. And it didn't make any difference to me. You know, it just didn't. I had the motto, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Let's go, you know. And so I started losing these jobs, and I was sick, and I was real sick physically. When you drink like I drank, and you put no food in the body, I don't care if you're 21 or 45, you're going to get sick. And I stayed sick. Physically sick, and it was real difficult for me to get dressed a lot of days. And one of the things I'm grateful for in sobriety is I can now put on eyeliner just one time. Because before it was four or five times. If I went to work at 8 o'clock, I had to start getting ready at 5:30, you know. And in doing, working these, the bars and the restaurants and whatnot, I met a lot of strange people and a lot of underhanded people and a lot of outlaws is what I met. Got into some pretty bad crowds and did some pretty rotten things. It just didn't matter, you know. It just didn't matter. I got, my bar closed at 12, the one that I started with. It closed at 12, and we used to go across the street from this bar, and we'd drink till the sun came up. Now, legally, we were only supposed to drink till 2, but we locked the doors at 2, and because it was all bar and restaurant people, and we'd stay there till 4 or 5 o'clock. And it was this time in my drinking when I started taking people home, you know. And I didn't even know their names, and it didn't matter. It was one-night stands, and I didn't care, because I just didn't want to go home alone. You know, I just didn't want to go home alone. And I'd wake up in the morning, and the other side of the bed be vacant, or he just left. And I didn't even know his name, you know. And I knew better, you know. And a lot of times when I go to these conferences, I hear my male counterparts sharing this same thing, you know, about all these dogs they woke up with. And I want to tell y'all, you don't look so good the morning after either. Thank you, ladies. I appreciate that. Now, wake up and look at you with no teeth in and her hair hanging down in her eyes and say, I love you, baby. No. I'll take morning meditation over that any day. Oh, me. I'm so glad I'm a lady now. But, you know, it got to where it just didn't matter, you know. It nothing mattered. And I know you all have gone through this, and is that you wake up in the morning and you look in that mirror and you say to yourself, you know, I'm not supposed to be living like this, and I know I'm not supposed to be living like this. And I know this isn't right, you know, and I swear to you, if I could have done better, I would have done better. But I didn't know what else to do. I, honest to God, didn't know what else to do. And it just seemed like somewhere along the line, life no longer mattered, you know, it just didn't matter. Somewhere along the line, I picked up that attitude. I knew I was going to die drunk. And I knew that one day they'd find me laying in a gutter somewhere downtown. And so it just didn't matter. And the more my alcoholism progressed, the more I wished that day would hurry up and get here. You know, I'm sick of being drunk. I would sit down alone at my kitchen table and with the bottle in front of me and wish to God I could drink myself to death. You know. And I'd start out, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to drink myself to death. But, of course, the body won't allow you to do that, and you pass out. And the next morning, you wake up, and you got to face that mess all over again. You know, with the same routine. You know, waking up, and in my case, I'd wake up, and I'd have a cut lip and a cut eye, and blood would be all over the place, and I'd wondered, my God, what happened? You know, who'd I hurt this time? How bad did I hurt him? I know. And I didn't know whether the ache in my body was from the beating I took the night before or just from drinking too much again. I just didn't know. I know. But it didn't matter, you see. It just didn't matter. I was trying to hold on to jobs, and I couldn't hold on to jobs. And I'd either get fired or I'd quit or I'd be too sick to show up. And the money was running out. and the men were running out because I couldn't hold anybody anymore. My temper was so bad, and a lot of them just feared for their lives. So they'd get out. And I called a guy I'd met in the bar and restaurant business, and his name was Pearl. And Pearl put me to work that night as a hooker on the streets of Atlanta. And it just didn't matter. And back then, the working girls wore fishnet hose and white go-go boots. And we used to call them hot pants. Mine were green satin and halters. And I'd walk in and out of those flea bag motels. And every once in a while, I'd get a glimpse of reality, and I'd think to myself, you know, what are you doing here? You were raised on the right side of town. You know, you came from the right area. What are you doing working a whore? You know, it just doesn't make sense. You're not supposed to be here. But it didn't matter. You see, you take a couple pops off that bottle, and it doesn't matter. It just doesn't hurt, and you just don't feel, and you just don't have to care about what you've become. And so those brief moments of sanity would leave, and by now the booze was just utopia. It wasn't that I got feeling good, it's just that I didn't feel anything. And that's what I wanted. I just didn't want to feel anything. And I didn't. I just didn't. And that's what I wanted. I was going with a guy, I was going with a lot of guys, but one in particular, and this is one of those fellows who's going to save my soul. We pulled up in front of his sister's house one night. She came out to the car. She looked me dead in the eye. And she said, "Don't you get out of that car. I don't want my children to see a woman like you. You stay in that car." And I just looked at her with all the hate and the bitterness that I could muster. And as soon as she turned her back and started to walk away, I reached under that seat and grabbed that bottle, because that was the only relief I had for what she said. I know. And the next morning I'd wake up and I heard that line 1,000 times if I heard it once. "I don't want my children to see a woman like you." And I could remember thinking to myself, you know, "I'm not going to hurt your kids, lady, okay? I don't know what's wrong with me. But I'm not going to hurt your kids. I'm not that bad. But you see, I look like what I was, and that woman had a right to say what she said. She had that right." I know. And people calling me that I didn't know, saying, "Stay away from my husband. No, leave him alone." A woman called me one night, good Christian lady. I'd been messing around with her husband a couple of years. She called me one night, and with all the love that she could muster, said, "Please leave him alone. He's all I've got. You're young. You can find somebody else." And in all my arrogance, I said to her, "If you were any kind of wife, he wouldn't be with me in the first place." And I hung up the phone. And I remember thinking as I hung up the phone, "What'd you say that to her for? Why did you talk to her that way?" But the only relief I had again was once more reach for that bottle and see, it didn't matter. It just didn't hurt. It was okay. It finally got, even in that profession, folks, you got to be able to walk. And that was getting to be more than I could handle. Laying down was no problem, but the walking was a real bear. And I went crazy, literally, I went crazy one night and called my mother, and because I was out of money and a way to make a living, I signed into a mental institute to get well. And the truth of the matter is, I signed in to let the state support me. And they put me on some funny pills, and because that was supposed to keep me from being violent, and it did. I walked around kind of comatose most of the time, and I really wasn't aware of what was going on with me. And I stayed on those a while, and then I told them I had to get off of them because I couldn't focus my eyes and I couldn't walk, and that was just like being drunk, you know. And I was scared of them. You won't hear me talk much about using pills or drugs, because I didn't. And that's not because I'm pure at heart. It's because I didn't need them. I will promise you that had booze not worked for me in my life, I'd have shot heroin, I'd have shot morphine, I'd have popped anything that I needed to pop to get me out of the misery I was in, because I simply couldn't cope. I just could not cope. But booze did it for me. And in this net ward one time, I remember I lost my cool and I was not a good patient, and you know how that upsets them. You know, if you start throwing things against the wall and that type of thing, and they'll charge you for being overreacting. And they would not allow me a weekend pass. And I used to have a weekend pass when I was a good patient to go home and see Mommy. And, of course, I didn't go home and see Mommy. I got drunk is what I did. Well, this particular weekend, they wouldn't let me do that, and I was very, very angry. But being the smart alcoholic that I was, you know what I did, because all of you would have done the same thing. I became the best patient that mental ward's ever seen. There wasn't an activity I didn't participate in. I talked to anybody who would listen. The counselors were so pleased with me. I told them everything they wanted to hear, all these new awarenesses I had discovered about myself. And in about 3 weeks, I went to my shrink, and I was real humble. You know how we get when we want something. I was real humble, and I had my head down, and I went to him, and I said that I knew I hadn't been a good patient. But I'd really put forth some effort the past 3 weeks, and I knew I didn't deserve a full pass. But if I could just have a three-hour pass to go home and get my winter clothes. And you know, when you do something like that, shrinks get so pleased, their eyes get about as big as half dollars, you know, and they're real proud what they did with this sicko. And he did just that. He was real pleased with me, so he gave me my three-hour pass, and I'm still out on that three-hour pass. Yeah. I had one of my friends, male friends, waiting for me, and he had a case of Miller's, and that was that. I really couldn't see the need in going back, you know. Life was fine once again. Yeah. That was to start the beginning of the end, so to speak, because after I left that nut ward, along with the nightmares that I had about that place. And see, I wasn't put on an alcoholic ward. I was put on a nut ward because I was suicidal, homicidal. And for those of you who don't know, that means I just soon kill me as kill you, or kill you as kill me. It just didn't matter. And they wouldn't let me out a lot of times. It was a locked ward. And they were to tell me once they wouldn't let me out because I was of danger to myself and to society. So I was a pretty sick person. And I remember nights on that ward, and I remember the other patients screaming, and I remember them dragging her down the hall and throwing her in a padded cell so the rest of us couldn't hear. And, you know, they could bolt that door on that padded cell, and I still heard her. And for years I heard her. And I saw the guy that we had that walked around and saluted generals that weren't there and had discussions of war strategy with upper echelon that weren't anywhere near him, and was highly insulted if you interrupted his conversation. And a friend of mine who was in there for drinking bleach, she was about as bad with the bleach as I was with the booze. You couldn't keep her away from the stuff, you know. You just put her out in the streets and she'd go for the bleach. And you know, these are tragedies. These are real human tragedies. And I remember one time there was a lady in there, and I didn't know anything. I wouldn't. Once I left the Catholic Church, I gave up on God, okay? I mean, I made a deal with God early on in my life. You stay out of my life, I'll stay out of yours, okay? Just leave me alone. And there was a gal in there, and she was a good Christian lady, and she was laying on the bunk one night. She was going through some problems, and she looked over at me, and she said, "Judy, have you ever been saved?" And I said, "From what?" I had no idea what the woman was talking about. None at all. You know, and I remember those, and to this day I remember those nights in that place. And God Almighty, I don't want to go back. I just don't want to go back. I went on, my mother and I have tried to piece this together, and we've never been able to come up with the exact day count, but it was somewhere between 10 to 14 days. I was gone. They could not find me. When I came to in a flea bag motel, I was still wearing the same clothes that I'd left the institute in. And to the best of my knowledge, I had not bathed in those 10 to 14 days. And I was up to the same old games that I'd been up to. I had had men around, it was obvious, by the state the room was in. And I hadn't let the maid in, that was obvious, by the state the room was in. And some soul came by and got me, and there again God was working in my life, because I'm not real sure how that happened either. And they took me to my mother's home and they poured me off in my mother's den. She was divorced from my stepfather by this time. My mother was to come home that day and find her 23-year-old daughter 10 to 14 days without a bath or a change of clothes. And I often wonder, you know, my God, what went through her mind, because there lay her firstborn child. Just a human wreck. You know, I'm a big believer that amends mean more than saying, I'm sorry. Because what did I do to her that day? I can't make up for it. You know, but on a daily basis, I try and be the best daughter that I can be. I call my mother on a regular basis. I spend as much time with her as I possibly can. I let my mother know I love her. You know, and sometimes I'll call Mama and she'll tell me about what she's fixing for dinner. And if it's roast beef, she's fixing roast beef the same way she's fixed roast beef for 39 years. But she will tell me how she's going to fix that roast beef. And because I am trying to be a good daughter, I will sit there and listen and say, that sounds good, Mom. You see, because I owe her that. I owe her that and a lot more. Oh, I'm sorry is just not enough. I tore her apart for years. A few days later, I was to try to commit suicide. It was no big deal to me, you know. And it really wasn't. I didn't write a note. I'd had it. I had it with living. So I went into that kitchen and I tipped up that bottle of pills and I went in my mother's den and I sat down and I waited to die. And again, my heavenly master was working in my life because my kid sister got up for some particular reason, unknown to me. And she took one look at me and how she knew I wasn't dead drunk again, I don't know. But she went in and she woke up my mother and said, you gotta get Judy to the hospital, there's something wrong. Oh. I can remember when I tipped up those pills and I sat down and I can remember the feeling of them taking effect and I could feel all the muscles in my body loosening up and I could remember thinking to myself, thank God it's over. Thank God tomorrow I don't have to get up and face this mess anymore, it's done. And I was glad, you know. And then to come to in that hospital again and listen to another shrink who's going to suggest group therapy, you know. And I told him what he could do with the group and the therapy, you know. And he was to walk out and he was to tell my mama that she might as well save herself a lot of grief and have me committed. Because as best as he could tell, I'd never get any better. I didn't want any help, you know. And the best thing for her to do was to put me away. And there again, what did that do to her? You know, my God, what did that woman feel? You know, she has to make a decision whether or not to commit her oldest daughter. My mother did the kindest thing for me 2 days later she's ever done in my life. She kicked me out of her house. Greatest service my mother ever did for me. She told me she was fed up with my behavior and that I would not come into her home and behave like that anymore, to get out. And I can still see to this day the look on her face. I can still see it. I am so grateful I haven't seen that look on her face in many years. Many years. I went to stay with my cousin Joanne, the last person on earth that would have me. And Joanne, God love her, was one of those that was going to fix me. Joanne was intelligent, and she had read a lot about alcoholism. She was very intrigued by the disease, and so she read a lot about it. And she found out how you treat an alcoholic to get him sober, see. So she knew she was going to fix me. And I went to stay with Joe, and inside of 3 weeks, she said, you got to pack your bags and go. I've never seen anybody drink like you. All the book knowledge went right out the window. It didn't help, and it never does with us. See, the book knowledge, with the exception of the big book, is based on logic. It's based on rational thinking. You're dealing with an alcoholic here. You know, we don't know logic and rational thinking. Joanne told me I had to leave. And I remember saying, I'll go. You know, I don't need you and I don't need anybody else. I'll go. And I walked to that door that cold December morning. And it hit me like ice water in the face. You got no place to go, lady. You got no place to go. I was 23 years old. I didn't have a friend in the world that would take me in. By now, when I called people, you know, and left a message for them to call me, they never returned my call. Never. Most of the time, if I got a hold of the individual that I wanted to talk to, they hung up. And I had no place to go. And somewhere along the line, I had seen a movie about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had my cousin Joe Duck call them for me. And I went to my first AA meeting that night. And I got to tell you about the 12-step call. Joanne loaned me some decent clothes to wear. And they come at 7:15, just like they said they would, right on time. And in walks this real good-looking guy, dressed to a T, and I thought, now, you know, this thing may not be bad at all. Maybe I should have done this earlier, you know. And right behind him was Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. And she was the perfect lady, you know what I mean? I mean, she had on white gloves and a little brown princess coat with the brown velvet collar, and that hair was, there wasn't a hair out of place. And I knew they sent the Holy Roller to save my soul. I just knew it would happen, see? Because now by this time, I was tough, and I worked on being tough. Because if you're tough, people will leave you alone. So I worked on it. So when I talk to you, I always had a cigarette hanging out of the corner of my mouth. And see, it kind of bob up and down, you know, as I spoke. Because that meant you were tough. And I cussed a lot. It embarrasses me now. I was talking to my sponsor one day, and I said, you know, I don't remember cussing that much. And two people that were there when I came in said, oh, yes, you did. Yes, you did. I went to the group, of course, on the right side of town. You wouldn't expect any less of me, would you? So I walked into this expensive group and on the right side of town. And I didn't fit in with the people there. Now, the guys I didn't have much trouble with, but the women were, they were uncomfortable by my presence, and rightfully so. Most of my wardrobe was satin and leather. I just didn't fit in. And I'd walk into these meetings and turn the air blue with what I'd say. And they were very kind, though, and they were very tolerant. And one of the ladies came up to me, the one who had the most nerve, and said, you know, there is a group over on the other side of town we really think you'd enjoy. And God works in mysterious ways in this program, and it was true. She said something along the lines, I got a lot of street drunks down there like you. And so the following day, I was to go to the Atlanta Biscayne Room. And my home group is the Saturday Night Night Owls, and we meet at the Atlanta Biscayne on Saturday nights at 11 o'clock. And I did walk into a group. I walked into a group of people who were just like me, you know. And I still stayed away from the women. And it wasn't because the women at the Biscayne were snobbish or too much of a lady. You see, it was just that I'd sunk too low, and I couldn't be with those kind of women. Even if they were kind of ladylike, I couldn't be with them. And I was always afraid that if we went somewhere, like out to dinner or something, they might see my pimp or somebody, and I didn't want them to be caught in that. You know? And I hung around with a couple of guys, and these guys were terrific to me. Big Jim and Dad. We called him Dad. His name was Leon D. And I called him Dad, and they had 8 and 12 years sobriety. You know, and they kind of took me under their wing, and they taught me things about living sober. And they taught me things they had lived, things that they had experienced in their life. Big Jim and Dad were big believers in talk what you walk. You know, if you hadn't walked it, don't talk it. And I can remember one day I came into the room, I was about 6 months sober. And there was a woman standing in the back of the room, and I was fixing to go after her. And it showed all over me. And I was walking towards the back, and Dad said to me, where are you going, baby? And I said, you see that broad back there? And he said, yeah. I said, I'm going to take her out in the parking lot. I've had it with her. It's the mouth all the time, and I've had it with her. Dad said, go get you some coffee and sit down. And I did. Because I love Dad, and I'd listen to Dad. And I got that coffee, and I sat down. I sat down on a little ottoman, and Dad was sitting in a recliner. Little man. And he said, now, baby, if you're going to live in society, you're going to have to learn to quit hitting people. And I sat there like a kid listening to a Christmas story, you know, because this is news to me, man. And I'm just sitting there listening. And what he did for me was, because, see, Dad used to have a problem with hitting people, too. See? And he shared with me what he did so that he didn't have to hit people anymore. And now, he talked about doing positive things with that negative energy. The things he used to do to keep himself busy so that he wouldn't think about the anger and the violence and that urge. And if any of you got it, you know what I'm talking about. You're just not going to feel better till you hit somebody in the jaw, you know? And that urge that would drive me. And he talked about that and what to do about it. And it was nice to know somebody else had been there. And somebody else knew about this rage I had inside of me that I didn't know what to do with. And somebody gave me something positive that they had actually practiced in their life, and it worked. And I could hold on to that, see? And I didn't hit that woman that day. I cussed her out, but I didn't hit her. And that was growth. Okay, just the fact that I cussed her out and I didn't hit her was growth. And Dad was standing right beside me just in case the talk didn't go too well, you know. But I felt that support there, and I knew Dad was there, and I knew Dad understood, and most importantly, I knew Dad loved me anyhow. You know, even though I wasn't ladylike, I knew Dad loved me anyhow. And Big Jim would say things to me. There were a lot of questions I'd bring to the people, and particularly when I was trying to work the program. You know, and Big Jim was always had those little pearls of wisdom. I went to Big Jim one time and I said, you know, if I start working these steps, now mind you, at this stage of the game, I'm 4 years sober. And I said, you know, if I start working these steps like y'all say, I may end up one of those old blue-haired, tight-lipped old ladies walking around going, and I just can't stand the thought of being there. Now, I just said, I'm afraid if I do this, I'm going to end up too good. And Jim looked at me, took a drag off a cigarette, kind of smirked, and said, don't worry, baby, it'll never happen. I was so worried they were going to appoint me to sainthood or something. Got into the program. By now I'm 23 and I'm not married yet, and that's scary if you're Catholic. So I decided I needed to find a husband, and it doesn't take long in AA. Three months sobriety, I put my hooks in one. I got married at 4 months, and he had 5 months. And it didn't, you know, it wasn't really a big deal. I didn't ask for much as qualifications. Wear pants and breathe, that's what by all I was looking for. But see, my intentions were good, and y'all understand intentions. I knew that if I got married, I'd clean up my act, see, and that was part of being respectable, because all the respectable ladies I knew were married. And so I knew that if I started there, then I could grow up and be respectable. So I got married, and shortly after the marriage, about 6 months, we make another brilliant decision based on clear alcoholic thinking. And that is, we need to leave the city life. Now, I have been city all my life. Asphalt and concrete's all I've ever known. We decide we're going to move to a small country community. I've got about 9 months sobriety now. And we move to a very small country community, Hiawassee, Georgia. Now, I didn't come in and buy new clothes because I had no money. If you don't think I turned some heads in Hiawassee, Georgia, in those fishnet hose and white boots. And my mouth was no better, you know. And I'm using words those folks hadn't heard. Yeah, and I made a mistake. I told them I was Catholic. You don't tell people if they're your Catholic. And then I put the icing on the cake and told him I was going to start an AA group in Hiawassee, Georgia. And that's the moonshine capital of North Georgia. They don't want us up there, you know. And it was to be a long, cold winter. I'll tell you, and I must share with you because I do it every time because it's real important to me. Up there. What happened was I found a God up there. See, now, prior to getting to y'all, I told you I just abandoned God. I made a deal with him. If he'd stay out of my life, I'd stay out of his. And he'd stay out of my business, I'd stay out of his. But the marriage was not going well, and I was hurting. And above all else, I didn't want to get drunk again. Above all else. And I went to God that day. My ex and I had had a horrible fight. And I was hurting like I'd never, ever hurt before. And behind the property we had rented up there, there's a small 8-acre lake. Little grassy knoll to one side and a big mountain behind it. And I took my two dogs and we went walking by that lake. And I remember looking up at that mountain and I remember saying, God, I don't know if you're up there. And I don't know if you can hear me. But I gotta have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. And I was crying so hard. And I'll tell you what happened. The air there became still. And it became warm and quiet. And I was aware that there was a God that heard me. And it was as though a close friend put his arm around my shoulder and said, you're going to be okay, baby. You're going to be okay. And I will never forget that feeling. See, for the first time in my life, on the inside, I was clean. For the first time. On the inside, there was that little piece of white velvet. Now, and I felt it. And every time I share that story, I feel that same way again. Every time. It never fails. I know that God loves me. I became aware that day that I am one of his children. I don't have to walk with my head hanging down. I can throw those shoulders back. I can throw that chin up. And I can face life head on. It's okay. It is okay. I'm okay. I'm one of his children. He wants me to be happy. No. He loves me. Yeah. And shortly thereafter, I was to leave Hiawassee and come back to Atlanta. God didn't give me any answers that day as to what to do. He just told me I was going to be okay. I felt it. And we're feeling people, you know. We're feeling people. We'd like to think we're thinking people, but we're not. We're feeling people. You know, and I felt it, and I knew I was going to be okay. And there were a lot of times after that I had some questions about whether he forgot me or not. If you're having trouble getting close to God, it's not because he moved. And that was to hold true with me. You know, somewhere along the line, I had let something else precede my relationship with my heavenly master. Somewhere along the line, I'd forgotten. Somewhere along the line, I forgot to be grateful. You know? Now, I will share with you, I was 5 years sober before I got out of being a minimum wage worker. And that's all right. It took me 5 years to get my head together. That's okay, because let me tell you, every dime I earned honest. I paid taxes on it. It was work. It was honest, decent work, like civilians, you know? Nothing under the table, nothing against the law. Yeah. So I was proud of that wage. Yeah. Because judging by my track record, I never should have worked a decent job again. Ever. So I was proud of it. And as time went on and I started to gain a few things materially, you know, I have to remember for me, I would have nothing in my life if it were not for this fellowship. I get a bit concerned, and if I sponsor anybody in the program and I see it happening, I'll let them know. You know, I get a bit concerned at the amount of a drop-off we have in AA membership after 5 years. And the reason I get concerned is because of what I see happening in too many groups. And that is, after you get 5 years, somewhere along the line, we feel like saying, thank you very much, AA, we appreciate your help, but now I'm going to go on and run my business. I'll come by to a meeting every now and then. You know, I owe everything to this program. I will never be paid in full. My account will always be, I owe you. You know, I had one little gal call me, and she's got her master's degree now, and she's an executive. And she couldn't get to meetings anymore because she's an executive. She made the mistake of telling me that. And I asked her point blank, Where would she have been had her home group not given her that support when she was going for that master's degree? When she wanted to quit and we said, baby, you're so close, don't give up now, keep going. You're so close, don't quit. I know. Where would she be when she was real worried about her exams and all of us kept saying, you've put forth the effort, you're going to make it, you're going to make it. I know. And now all of a sudden she's too busy? And what about the next one who comes in with 7 years and decides she wants to go for her master's? Who's going to have the experience to share because the executive's now too busy? I know. Call me when you got something to say besides I got a promotion. That doesn't impress me a bit. What impresses me is how many drunks have you worked with? How many people have you talked to? How many times have you gotten up out of your chair in a meeting and fixed a pot of coffee instead of waiting for somebody else to do it? And we can get caught up in that. And the sadness of that is that who she was shortchanging was herself. AA will survive without people like that, but she was shortchanging herself. Because, you see, there's no greater joy than knowing that God has allowed you to participate in a human being coming back to life. There is no greater joy. There was a young man at my house the other night sharing with me. And for 14 years, this man has been carrying around something that was atrocious. And he felt guilty, and he felt awful, and he felt less than human. For 14 years, that boy had carried that garbage. And he sat in that den, and he shared. And he cried. And let me tell you about this boy. He's a big guy. Big bruiser. Not the kind I'd want to meet in a dark alley, I'll guarantee you, you know. Big fella, tattoos all over his body. And he sat there like a baby and cried. Because of the guilt and the shame that he had carried. You know. And we loved him. And we told him it was okay. And we told him what to do based on our experience with guilt and shame. And I talked to him before I came up here. And he shared something with me that was beautiful. He said, guess what, Jude? Last night was the first night that I have slept without a nightmare in 14 years. You know, I went to bed early and I couldn't get up. I slept all night and no nightmares. You know? And man, I couldn't bring myself down. I was just so high. You know, and I said, I love you, baby. And he said, I love you too. No more nightmares. Oh. And all I had to do was listen. And all I had to do was share. And my feeling is, and this is my feeling, any drunk can read this book. Any drunk can read it. Any drunk can go to a meeting for 6 months and steal from somebody else what they read out of the book. But when you sit down eyeball to eyeball and you tell that new one, I've been there, this is what I did. That's when you're living this program. You know, there were some who were kind of flippant about what the book says when I was trying to get sober. And they'd say, well, just turn it over. And I'd say, turn what over? You don't know what a mess I got here. You know, my life's falling apart. Turn it over and turning around and walking away and leaving that poor individual suffering there is not an answer. It's a cop-out. What have you got as far as experience? What can you reach for in the depths of your soul and say, here, baby, you know, this is what happened and this is what I did. It takes more than knowledge of the big book. I am a firm believer. I was a 24-hour-a-day alcoholic. I better learn to live this program 24 hours a day. And that means at home. Now, if there's one place that it's hard to practice this program, it's in the house. It's when you don't have AA folks around. You know? And you have to practice it with the ones that you live with. Or in some cases, the ones that you work with. And you've got to be honest with them, and you can't be selfish and self-centered because the book doesn't tell us that we exclude family. You know, it tells us we have to live this, and to me that means at home. That means that when I come home and I've had a rough day, my husband does not have to pay the price. It's been my rough day. That means that when he does something that's thoughtful and caring, I'm supposed to say thank you. It absolutely amazes me we will not thank our own families. We'll thank a total stranger for opening the door, but we won't thank our own family. You know, and the understanding and the caring. It has to be at home. Sobriety is not a matter of convenience. Not as I see it. I know what I go back to. You know, I'm too old to work the streets anymore, so my only option's the institutions. No. I can't do this. That's the only option I've got. I am dead serious about my sobriety. I was raised by people in the program who did not coddle me. I was raised by people in the program who just as soon hit me with a 2x4 as look at me. I had tough sponsors, and I'm grateful. Because I was one that would con you, and if I could have found a patsy, I'd take you for a ride as long as I could. And we all believe that the way that we're sponsored is the best way to be sponsored, and that's the way I sponsor today. No, I don't cut any slack, because bottom line is, I'm a whole lot more concerned about you living than you liking me. You know, that's my job as a sponsor. I'm not running a personality contest here. Now, bottom line is, I'm giving with you, to you, what I have learned as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to shove it down your throat, but I'm not going to listen to your whining either. I was irresponsible all my life. I pushed blame on everybody all my life. I'm not going to do it in this program. No, and my sponsors wouldn't let me. No. I tell them a lot of times, I don't want to hear it. Call me back when you want to do something. Don't call me for sympathy. That's the first rule. Understanding and compassion, yeah, but sympathy you won't get from me. No. Alcoholics don't need sympathy. Compassion, understanding, yeah, but not sympathy. Because this is bottom line Save Your Life program. I know there's a whole lot of different things that are coming in, and I don't worry about them. I don't worry about them because, as I've learned in my experience, that if Alcoholics Anonymous will not fix them, they won't stay. They'll go. You know, it makes you uncomfortable to sit and listen to their stuff, but they'll go. So I don't worry about it. But I think that my feeling is that we really need to embrace the basic core of this program, which is keep it simple. Dr. Bob told us to keep it simple. My teachers kept it simple. You know, when I went to my first AA meeting, I learned the first pearl of wisdom that they were to drop on me. And I remember when I sat in that meeting, they asked me as they came around the table, and it was the end of the meeting, and then they said, Judy, do you have any questions? Is there anything you'd like to know about us? And I said, no, I just don't want to drink anymore. I am sick to death of being drunk. And they told me I never had to drink again. Now, I will stand before you today and tell you that is a truth. You don't have to come in and out of AA 50 times. Okay? You can come to your first meeting or be in your first year and you can stay sober. You don't have to go back out and drink. You know, and who are you proving it to anyway? You want us to know you're alcoholic for sure? No. No. If you're sitting out there with 2 to 3 years sobriety and you're thinking about killing yourself, you're okay, baby. That's truth. At 2.5 years sobriety, I could not think of a way that my life was going to get any better. I could not envision it getting any better. Okay? But let me tell you what I came to realize. At that stage, I had conditioned myself that suicide was an option. Drinking wasn't. I had grown enough to know that drinking wasn't going to solve it. Now, I'm not telling you that suicide's healthy thinking either, but what I'm saying is that it's better. It is better for the alcoholic. And then you grab a hold of somebody and sit down and share, because you got that little piece of garbage you're carrying around you don't want to let go of. And I'm here to tell you, although we dress up good and we clean up good, this is not a pure bunch. Yeah. And we all got something to share. And then you'll have those joys too, to where somebody will come to you and they'll be nervous, and you know they got something deep inside of them they really don't want to let you know. You know. I was sitting one time in the back seat of a car, and one of my sponsors was driving, and a new gal was sitting in the front seat with her, and I always sat in the back seat because I didn't want anybody sitting behind me. You know, some of us go through that. And new gal came, we were getting ready to go to a meeting, we were waiting on somebody, and new gal came out of the room, and This one gal that was sitting in the front seat with Maggie pokes her in. See that girl coming out of there? I heard she's sleeping with every guy in the room. Maggie didn't say anything. The woman says, and they all do this, they all got this one thing, they do this. Well, I don't know that it's true. But I heard she used to be a whore. And right about the time I was getting ready to jump over that back seat, Maggie turns to her and says, at least she had sense enough to sell it, honey. You know, and I kind of sat up and thought, well, now I'm kind of proud. But what that said to me was, you'll be accepted. It doesn't matter. It's okay. That's what I heard. You know, and it is okay. It really is okay. As long as we try to do the best that we can do. What we think God wants us to do. If you're trying to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, and you're fighting it, ask yourself, what am I holding on to here? You know, I'm sleeping in a car and I haven't got a decent change of clothes and I'm fighting giving this to God. You know, my life was a shambles and yet I wanted to hold on to it. Yeah, and the growth and the beauty. And my life today is nice. My life today is respectable. I own a little gift shop, silk flower shop, you know. And I make these little wreaths and little old ladies come in and worry about if the pink's the right color pink or not. You know, and it's wonderful. I've never been happier in my life. I enjoy that. I enjoy the relationship I have with my mother. My mother told me one day, she said, Judy, you're a good daughter, and you're a good person, and Mama loves you. See, those are the kind of benefits you can't buy. You can't buy that. You know, I've had three people ask me if something were to happen to them, would I take their children? Those are the kind of benefits you can't buy. See, because women like me weren't supposed to be around children. I served on jury duty. I said a prayer before I went in that God would let me have an open mind and not let him go, no matter what he did, you know. Yeah, but that was neat because the county then sent me a certified letter saying that I was a good citizen, you know. And I was real excited about it. Yeah, I mean, I went to my home group and shared it. I got it in writing from the county, man. I'm a good citizen, you know. Yeah, and say good morning to the police that patrol our neighborhood. And I can guarantee you I never said good morning to police when I was drinking. That was the last thing I said to cops. Yeah, you know, and I wave at my neighbors. And I've got a good marriage. I got a 12-year marriage now. Oh, yeah, and my husband is also a member of the fellowship. Craig, would you stand up, please, honey? My husband was a junkie, but I married him anyhow, you know. And we've got a good marriage and we've got an AA home because, you see, it was God's blessing. That home was God's blessing. And we've had drunks in there and had them drying out because that's where they wanted to come and that's where they were comfortable. And it's okay because, like I say, it's God's house. You know? And we've had them live there for a while and that's okay too. And the rules that I lay down in that house are tougher than any rules they're going to get anyplace else, and they know that, but that's okay. And I'm glad that we're able to do that, because, see, for a long time in my sobriety, I had to worry about where the money was coming from for food, you know? It's bad news to stand in a welfare food line, which you had to do when I first came in. You couldn't get food stamps. I never did that drunk. And at a year's sobriety, I'm getting surplus food from the government. And that's okay. I know. That's what it had to be for me. So I'm grateful now that I can offer food to those that are hungry and put a roof over their head so they can get on their feet. And it's a beautiful life. And to be a part of the lives of the people I sponsor is beautiful. It's a gift that I often wonder why God's blessed me with it, but it truly means very much to me. And I am rich today. I am very, very rich today. My checkbook wouldn't show you that, but that's not the kind of rich I'm talking about. I'm talking about the kind of rich where I wake up in the morning and I no longer say you're a no-good tramp. And I can wake up in the morning and say, hey, you know, you're not bad, and I like you. You're all right. You're a decent human being. You know? And I take pride in the way that I look. I don't have to look like trash anymore. You know, and I take pride in the fact that I'm a child of God. And that's all because of this program. Nothing else. Nothing else. Nothing I did. They told me, you know, just get up, clean up, and show up. It tells us, and as Bill sees it, that if we want permanent sobriety, there has to be a profound personality change. And I have wanted permanent sobriety since the day I walked in here. And I truly feel that God has allowed me to have that profound personality change. It's been 7.5 years since I hit anybody. Thank you. I'm glad somebody appreciates that. This is the most beautiful paragraph to my way of thinking in the book. There's a lot of beauties, but this is my favorite. And if you don't know where it is, read the book until you find it. And it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you all.
I think you're okay.
I do too.
We have a gift for you. It's a very special gift, and after the meeting, if Judy would share this, I would love for you to see it. It's quite a unique gift, and it's my pleasure to give it to you, and I hope you'll remember us in Chattanooga with much fondness, as we will remember you.
Thank you.